As you know, I was raised in an environment of books. When I was very young, I used to simply take the books out and handle them. As I got older, I read many of the books. In our house, the living room had been turned into a library. There were books on the landings of the stairs, there were books in the basement, there were books in every bedroom. About the only public room in the house which didn't have books was the dining room, and I wasn't ever quite sure how its walls escaped. I had recently the occasion to handle those books again. As you know, my mother moved this summer from the old homestead, and the books had to be reshelved and replaced. And I went through them one by one, bringing sets back together, weeding out duplicates, putting aside the books which had become outdated or obsolete. And in the process of handling these books, of being with books for a good part of the summer, in a physical sense, I came to a conclusion which I had not expected. I grew up believing that the relationship of books and civilization was incontestable, and that the relationship of books and Judaism was a direct and simple love affair. I couldn't imagine Judaism without books, and I couldn't imagine that Jews had always revered the book. Yet the more I handled the books and more I thought about books, the more I became convinced that the relationship of Judaism and books is not quite as simple and as direct as I had once thought it to be. And I'd like this morning to, in a sense, lay this argument before you. Let me begin at the beginning. As you remember from your school days, the first printed pages emerged from a press which had been put together by Johann Gutenberg, an Alsatian metallurgist and engraver, sometime around the year 1440. He managed to assemble a press to cut the blocks of type, and he pulled a number of pages. We believe the first pages were from the Psalms. And with those first pages, the first sheets of the history of modern civilization were written. Because modern civilization depends upon communications, depends upon the accumulation of knowledge. And the printed word can cover distance, and the printed word can cross the generations. And once it's printed, it can be shelved in a library, and scholars and researchers can go back and find the book and apply themselves to its teachings. But as always in history, things are not quite as simple as we were taught that they were. And I refer now not only to the fact that a number of careful researchers have discovered that there were a number of Johann Gutenbergs working at about the same time, that the printing press was one of those inventions which was just about to happen, and that in France and Germany and Alsace and in Italy, there were engravers who had about come to the moment when the printing press developed. They're not quite sure that the first pages were those of Johann Gutenberg, but that's not quite as important as the fact that printing as an art antedates Gutenberg by many centuries. Actually, the first printed book, that is the first printed book of which the world still owns a copy, is a Buddhist sacred book called the Diamond Sutra, which was printed in China in the year 868 of the Common Era, nearly 600 years before Gutenberg. And we know from history that there were single sheets and books printed in China for at least 100 years before the Diamond Sutra. Printing then is a very ancient art. The Chinese were never able to maximize the advantage of printing. In the West, printing announced the beginning of modern times. In China, printing did not. And the difference seems to be not so much one of technique, but that the West possessed a unique advantage which was unknown to China. In China, to be literate, one had to master, to be able to read, thousands upon thousands of pictograms and ideograms of symbols for concepts and for words and for objects. China never developed the alphabet. And because China never developed an alphabet, a printer could never set a page of type and then break it down and use the letters of the alphabet over again. What they had to do in China was to cut a wood block of a single whole page and print that page. And obviously when that book was printed, there was no other use possible for the wood block. One had to begin the next book all over again, page by page by page. It was expensive, it was time consuming. And instead of moving towards mass literacy, which printing helped to develop in the West, China retained literacy and printing as an accomplishment and a technique which served a small scholar class who achieved control of the language by dint of years and years and years of hard work. And printing was never became the cheap and efficient means of communication that it developed into in the West. The alphabet, our ABCs, which every school child learns its his or her first week in school, the alphabet, which we take for granted, is in fact the key element in the importance of printing. The techniques were there, the Chinese had them. They had the ink, they had the blocks, they had the paper. What was missing was the alphabet, the simple ABCs that we take for granted. When men first wrote, as you know, they used symbols for objects. If you wanted to signify the sun, you drew a circle and some lines as the rays of sunlight. And then as they began to try and develop more complex words, they tended to break down the word into its component parts. If you wanted to use the word sunflower, you drew a sun and then the outline of a flower, because you couldn't suggest different kinds of flower by the simple kinds of outlines that writing permitted you. And then men learned how to use symbols for certain kinds of concepts which could not be directly pictured. Verbs of motion, concepts which are not based in reality, love, fear, anger. If you wanted to speak of speed, you drew a line, a wiggly line, which went as far as you could take it. This was the way most people wrote in most civilizations. And only in the West did men learn to devise a symbol of symbols which did not signify any object in the world. An alphabet is a purely arbitrary set of signs, just like the numbers, which do not refer to objects. You don't have a picture image of what they represent. Rather, they refer to sounds. And when you put the 26 letters of our alphabet together, they can, in various combinations, make every sound of which our mouth is capable. And because they can signify all of these sounds, we sound them out. And the sounds make the words. Until that time, the words had referred to objects rather than to sounds. The development of the alphabet is one of the most important, the key discoveries ever achieved by man. And it was discovered in Western Asia sometime around the 15th century before the Common Era. The word alphabet. And every little Jewish child, boy, went to school, he learned his Aleph Beit, his A, B's. Actually, the etymology of alphabet does not come from the Hebrew Aleph Beit, but from the Greek, Alpha, Beta, which suggests simply that both the Greeks and the Jews ganafed the alphabet from those whom the Jews called the Canaanites and those whom the Greeks called the Phoenicians, because it was the Phoenicians, Canaanites, who invented the alphabet. The earliest alphabet that we know of comes from Western Syria. It was discovered in the year 1905 by a man named Flinders Petrie. It's one of a number of alphabetic cases from that part of the world which have now been unearthed by archaeologists. Somehow the people of Western Asia made this quantum jump between the pictograph, the ideograph, the thing, the symbol that signified a thing, and the symbol which signified only a sound. And within a century, Judaism began to be born. And I've always felt that there was a more than a chance connection between the development of the alphabet in Western Asia and the development of Judaism in Western Asia. Not simply because we have a scroll, a book in our ark, we think of ourselves as the people of the book. Language and writing are important to us and seem always to have been. There were other people in Western Asia who had sacred books and they never developed the alphabet. The Egyptians are a classic case in point. but largely because I have a feeling that our concept of God could not have emerged among a people which did not use an alphabet as opposed to hieroglyphs or pictographs or sign language. The Bible asks, El mi tadamuni, to whom will you liken me? Me being God. And the answer, of course, is God is not to be likened to anything that is in the heavens above or on the earth below or in the waters under the earth. God is pure spirit. God is one, pure existence, beyond all description and beyond all attribution. But as long as people required a sign as the name of God, a sign which was which caused them to think in their minds of an object, of a thing, so long, I suspect, did they find it difficult, if not impossible, to think of God as pure spirit. Only a people who controlled an alphabet, where the name signified nothing on heaven and earth, only among such a people could the concept of the God who is our God, pure spirit, pure being, really have emerged. The alphabet precedes our theology. Only when we could begin to think of God as having a name consisting simply of a number of horizontal and vertical lines in various combinations which come together to form a sound, only at that point, I suspect, could people come to the concept of the one invisible God, pure being, of whom no attributes can be assumed. The alphabet is basic to Judaism. But having said that, I must say that our assumption that the book has always been basic to Judaism is not as well-founded. I read to you this morning from the 22nd and 23rd chapter of the second book of Kings, a chronicle of the kings of Israel. And I read to you the first mention of a book to be found in the Bible. The year is the 7th century, the late 7th century before the Common Era, 500 years. Half a millennium after the time of Moses, the very end of the period of the first commonwealth. There are workers in the temple. While refurbishing the temple, they claim that they have found a scroll of the covenant. They bring the scroll to the scribe. The scribe brings it to the king. The king has a prophetess, Huldah, authenticate it. It's read aloud to the people. It's the first time in which writing, a scroll, a manuscript, is associated with our people. The concept of Talmud Torah, of study as being a form of devotion to God, so basic to Rabbinic Judaism, did not exist in biblical times. As far as we know, if they had synagogues, there was no scroll in their ark. That's again a Rabbinic accomplishment. We read this morning the great paragraph from Deuteronomy 6, which is read in every Jewish service and has been read in these services for the last 2,000 and more years. And thou shalt love the Lord thy God with all thy heart, with all thy soul, and with all thy might, which includes the command, v'shinantem levanecha, and ye shall teach them to thy children. And we immediately think of the old rabbi bent over a sefer, bent over a book, teaching the children, parents teaching the children from books. But the biblical image is without books. It's an oral tradition. On Passover night, when the Haggadah was retold, it was an oral Haggadah. They simply told orally the history of the Passover. Most of the people of biblical times were illiterate. There was a small professional band of scribes who wrote for the people and read to the people. But our people did not become a literate community until after the destruction of the temple, after the triumph of Rabbinic Judaism, and then they became, in very short order, a literate community, but not until then. The very word, the people of the book, which we often so often hear in reference to Jews, is not a title we have ascribed to ourselves in self-respect, but is a title which was given to us by Muhammad, of all people. In the Quran, in a number of places, Muhammad refers to the Hebrews, to the Jews, as a people of the book. And in so doing, he signifies not our devotion to Torah, our literacy, but our legal status. According to Muslim practice, any religious group in Dar al-Islam under the control of an Islamic community, which does not own a scripture, which does not own allegiance to a Bible, such a group is to be deemed pagan, heathen, and is not to be allowed to survive. Only those groups which have a sacred scripture, which have reached that level of religious development, are to be allowed to survive. We are one of them. We are a people of the book. And somehow over the years, that title got transposed because one identified Judaism, rabbinic Judaism, in the book. The synagogue was a school, a shul, shule, a Beit HaMidrash, a place of study. The senior ecclesiastic among Jews was the rabbi, the teacher, whose proficiency was that of literacy of the book. Our great scholars were all writers and readers and commentators. We had a Torah in our ark. We called writing Melechet Hashamayim, holy work. It was important for us that writing and literacy be universal, at least among our men. And those who looked at us from the outside world, from the medieval world, where writing was such a rigidly limited achievement, they looked at us and they wondered, for they knew us as a literate people, a bookish people, and they somehow came to apply Muhammad's old legal title to us as a title of respect and of definition. A people of the book, but what kind of book? And here I found myself this summer more and more convinced that we are less a people of the printed book than we are a people of the handwritten book, the manuscript. I came across an interesting volume while I was browsing through the library this summer. Frankly, didn't know it existed. It's called the Shilte HaGiborim, the Shields of the Mighty. It was written by an interesting fellow. He lived in Italy in the late 16th and early 17th century. His name was Abraham Portaleone. He lived in Mantua. Abraham Portaleone was a late Renaissance kind of figure, a man who was master of many trades. He earned his livelihood as a physician. He wrote, apparently, a number of first-rate medical books. He was something of an astronomer, something of a mathematician, something of a logician, something of a biologist. He was also something of an eclectic Hebrew scholar. And around 1606 or 1607, Abraham Portaleone had a bad heart attack, and he was partially paralyzed. He'd grown old, he had grandchildren, and as is the will with some grandparents, he set out to make sure that his grandchildren would have the advantage of every bit of learning he had ever amassed. And so he sat from morning to night writing a massive tome in which he set out in purely idiosyncratic fashion, his encyclopedia of knowledge, everything he knew. And he knew a lot of things, and he knew a lot of things that weren't so. And he was one of these men, you've met them, I've met them, who believe, you know, that we were there first. If man flies, somehow Jews flied first. In this case, he has a long chapter which we might entitle, "We Invented Printing Before Johann Gutenberg." And what's the proof? The best proof of all, the Bible. If you look at the 19th chapter of the book of Job, you'll find that Job has been made absolutely weary by his comforters. He's tried to tell them again and again and again, this is what I feel. I don't feel guilty. I have not sinned against God. Yet all of these things have come upon me, and I am not resigned. Job wonders, why can't they hear what I'm saying? Why do I have to keep repeating myself? And the language which he uses reads this way. Oh, that my words were now inscribed in a book. Oh, that with an iron pen and lead they were graven indelibly. Now, the iron pen is obviously the engraver's tool. The lead is obviously the slug of the type. And the graven indelibly is obviously the book that results, QED. In the days of the Bible, Jews had printed books. Who can doubt the Bible? And long he goes on at great length, my friend Portaleone, to tell his children of the many wonders of our people who had anticipated all the great achievements of civilization before men ever dreamed that these achievements were possible. Now, as I read Portaleone's volume, I was struck not only by its absurdity, but I was struck by the fact that I knew of no other place in which Jews had claimed the printing press, and in fact, I was struck by how little Jews made use of the printing press. There's a term used by bibliographers. It's called incunabula, which means cradle books. An incunabula is any sheet of paper which was printed between the invention of printing around 1440 and the year 1500. And those who bother to number such things say that there still exist in the world copies of 35,000 printings, single sheets, broadsides, or books, which were pulled from the presses of Europe in those 60 years. And those who continue and make other kinds of lists go on to say that 175 of these 50,000 volumes or sheets are sheets which include Hebrew writing. That is, at the very most, 175 of 50,000 pieces somehow were of relevance to the Jewish community. And as I look down the list, I recognize that most of these 175 were not written by Jews for Jews, but by Christian biblical scholars for the benefit of their Christian ministerial students. During those first 60 years of printing, Jews made very little use of the printing press. Now, what's the explanation? Well, one explanation immediately suggests itself is that the printing presses were owned by Christians. Maybe Jewish books could not have been printed. This was the guild system was still in effect. Printing was by and large a Christian monopoly. Well, we know that in the year around the year 1469, one of the presses of Italy produced the commentary of Rashi to the Torah. And within the next two or three years, the commentary of Nachmanides to the Torah was printed in Hebrew. A commentary of Levi ben Gershon to the Torah was printed in Hebrew. The grammar of David Kimhi was printed in Hebrew. The rabbinic responsa of Salmon ibn Bedret was printed in Hebrew. There was Hebrew type. And obviously, still in those early years, Christian presses were prepared to print Hebrew books. So the explanation is not simply the Christianity of the owners of the presses. The explanation, I think, is more spiritual than economic. The explanation, I think, lies in the fact that Jews somehow felt that the printed book, the ease, the cheapness with which books could be printed, did violence to something that was basic to their way of life, their way of doing the business of faith. To us, the scribe had been a religious person, not simply a professional letter writer. He wrote the Torah with very precise instructions. He had to be an honorable man. He had to be well-schooled in the literature. He had a place of responsibility, and he had respect in the community. And long after the invention of printing, to this very day, we Jews obstinately hold on to the fact that many of the most sacred writings among us must still be written by hand. A Sefer Torah, still in this year 1976, with all the photo offset methods available, must still be written by hand. A ketubah, a marriage contract, must still be written by hand. A bill of divorcement must be written by hand. The parchment, which is in the mezuzah's case, must be inscribed by hand. The inscriptions which go into the boxes of the tefillin must be written by hand. We hold on obstinately to the value of the manuscript, of the handwritten manuscript. And if you ask why, the answer is not a Luddite answer that we were afraid of machines, so much as it is an answer as to the effect of the book upon the way in which man learns, the way in which his mind reacts to the world about him. What is Rabbinic Judaism? Rabbinic Judaism is essentially a few classic volumes which were studied and studied and studied again. Hafoch bei v'hafoch bei dekule bei. Turn them over and turn them over, for everything is in them. One scholar would write a commentary in the margin. Another scholar might write a commentary on the commentary. Another one a commentary on the commentary on the commentary. You studied Talmud. You studied the Zohar. You studied some of the great codes. And those were the books. And if you mastered those books and the basic commentaries on them, you really had immersed yourself into the universe of discourse, which was Judaism. You were a Jew. The Jew read in depth. He read patiently. He studied his books. There weren't a great number of books. You can't go out and simply buy a paperback edition of a handwritten Talmud. It took years to write a Talmud. It took years to write a Zohar. It took years to write one of the codes. Trivial books were not written out by hand. They were trivial. No one would take the time to do it. There were a few sacred books which were copied over and over and over again and studied over and over and over again. And these books were infinitely precious. And some of the few remaining wills which we have from the Middle Ages tell us that among the most sacred possessions of the Jews, the most valuable, now in a purely materialistic sense, the most valuable possession of Jews were the manuscripts which they owned, the handwritten manuscripts. Now comes the book. And whereas the scribe had done sacred work, it was Melechet HaKodesh, sacred work, for printing, the Jews borrowed the simple word typus, type. The Hebrew word for printing is defus, simply the word typus, type. It was simply a commercial undertaking. Now books could be brought off the press in great numbers. Now science and knowledge could multiply. Now the reader, instead of being patient and reading in depth and studying every angle of every sentence, he had to read broadly. We suddenly had to become what I call hot rod readers, speed readers, burning up page after page after page on a given night. I wonder what one of the great sages would have thought of a student of mine whom I asked a question the other day, and her answer revealed that she really didn't know the first thing about the Bible stories. And I asked her, had she ever read the Bible? And she said, yes, she had to skim it one night for an assignment in school. Well, that's how we read. And we have machines to do a lot of the reading for us. And we have to do that. Such is the magnitude of knowledge today. I remember when I first went to college, the freshman advisor I was assigned lived in the fourth sub-basement of Widener Library. And as I went to his room, I must have walked past miles and miles of books. Now, I assure you that none of the great sages of our people had more than a shelf or two of manuscripts. Those manuscripts, they knew, forwards and backwards and in depth. And somehow, I have a feeling that the relationship of the Jew to printing was a recognition that there was something to be lost for all of its gain. Yes, books would now be more readily available. Yes, texts could now be standardized. In every manuscript, there are errors. But now there could be a standard form of reference. Now there could be indices of all kinds. There were great advantages to the book. Our people never fought books as such. They never broke type. They were never unwilling to become printers. But somehow this no longer was sacred work. This no longer was the world in which had nurtured rabbinic Judaism. This was no longer the world in which a few basic texts and the control of those texts made and defined the Jew. I recognized this in myself this summer. To a Jew, there can be nothing worse than book burning. I remember once writing a book try and exonerate one of the men whom I revere in a medieval tradition, Jonah Gurundi, from the charge of having told the Inquisition that there were heretical materials in some of the writings of Maimonides, and the Inquisition in southern France then got whatever copies the Guide to Perplexed were available and burnt them on a pyre. It's a terrible charge to be leveled against a Jew that he contributed to a book burning. But what was I to do with all those volumes of trivial fiction, of scandal, those volumes which become instant bestsellers and which we have long since forgotten about, which accumulate on any shelf? The books we pick up to when we fly on an airplane, the books we pick up for a vacation. Why not burn them? I began to ask that of myself. How else was I to get rid of some of these books that I had bought here or there or had been given me, which were vulgar or trivial or worse? And I came to recognize that insofar as books have become part of our civilization, we Jews have had to adjust to the end of an era. And the new learning, of which we are all the products, cannot be the old learning. The new learning requires breadth, and to get breadth, you sacrifice depth. No modern rabbi can know the the Talmud or the Midrash or the code the same way his great-great-great-grandparents did, because he has to learn so much else. And it matters not how many hours he spends in the learning. His learning will be different. Perhaps modern Judaism begins with the printing press and not with Moses Mendelssohn and the Enlightenment at the end of the 18th century. Because the minute we're forced to read in extensively rather than intensively, at that moment we become, you know, in a sense, different kinds of people and different kinds of Jews. And I began to think upon this, and I began to recognize that the relationship between Jews and books was not quite the simple one it had been. To our fathers, books meant power. And the Torah was the visible presence of God, and the Talmud and the codes were the visible wisdom of the inspired teachers of our tradition. Books had power, and that's why the medievals were so concerned about what was in the book, and so often censored books. One of the things I discovered as I went through these shelves this summer were the number of books which had in the back of them a handwritten inscription which would say, well, might be simply a name, Don Giovanni Careto, the Dominican John of Careto, and a year, 1607. I have such a little book. It's called the Arzei Levanon, the Cedars of Lebanon. It's a collection of 7 or 8 little pamphlets by Jews and grammar and medicine and a number of other things. It came to Padua. Don Giovanni Careto was the official censor in 1607 in Padua. And this probably apostate Jew had to read the book before the Jew could keep it in his home and sign at the end of the book that it was acceptable. It did not contain materials which were deemed censorable, heretical by the church. Any number of the medieval texts that I possess have ink lines all through the book, where a church censor has gone in and inked out phrases or sentences or paragraphs because they seem to cast suspicion on one truth or another that was taught by the church. The church, its censors, the Jews, believed that the book was a powerful instrument. We don't. We accept the book, we find it functional and useful, but let a book drop today. And we'll not do what our fathers did, was just to pick it up and to kiss it, to make it whole as they would a child. We'll simply pick it up and worry if we've broken the back, but that's the end of it. We're a different people of a different age. The old age cannot be, recreated. And even as I say it, I wonder what will the new age be like? Because even as I was thinking about books and manuscripts, my son was reading about Marshall McLuhan in the mass media. And I wondered what the future held in store for our Judaism. We still read books. Will the next generation? And how will a Judaism express itself which must be seen or felt or touched or related to by all of the senses and not simply the mind and the spirit? It's interesting, isn't it, how much external things affect the life, the history, the development of a faith. What was, has been. What is in the process of changing. What I hope will never change is that one way or another, our people will somehow hold fast the old values implicit in a book. The book. There is value in having, in sharing a single tradition. There's value in the fact that we as Jews share the Bible and share some great legends and share a tradition which is written and inscribed. This gives consistency, cohesion to the community. For otherwise, each of us every day is subject to a whole variety of outside stimuli. We are always being pulled apart. It's only a book, books, as well as this sense of community which we have here at a moment like this, which gives us cohesion, which keeps it together. And the insight which I came to is not a new one. I found it in the Bible itself, the very closing chapter of the scroll known as Ecclesiastes. Long before there was printing, Long before there were many books in the world, the sage who wrote Ecclesiastes sighed, "To the making of books there is no end." And certainly our modern presses prove the point. I hope you'll all read. And I hope you'll all continue to have that reverence for literacy which has been part of modern Jewish life. At the same time, I hope that you'll, in some way, as a religious act, as a mitzvah, devote yourself to patient reading and rereading of at least one of the sacred texts of our people, the Bible, the sayings of the fathers, some one of the beloved texts. If each of us would accept that as an act of religious devotion, the ties of the Jewish community would be closer. And more importantly, we'd find the depths of wisdom which are in these books. Because these books are great books. They're classics. Otherwise, they would not have survived centuries.